Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
I walk through the forested mountains with the birdman, whose well-honed calls entice the largely hidden wildlife into view. Once in the midst of warfare, this area of central Vietnam is beginning to reveal its secrets as an unimagined haven of natural diversity.
11 new animal and plant species have been discovered in a remote area of Vietnam. Researchers have found a snake, 5 orchids, 2 butterflies and 3 other plants new to science and exclusive to tropical forests in the Annamite mountain range in Tua Tuen Hue province.
Biological windfalls like this are confirming Vietnam as home to an array of plants and animals found nowhere else on Earth. Yet it's a country whose thriving illegal wildlife trade and strong drive for development is putting many of these unique species at grave risk.
It's disastrous. Roads are being built through areas for no good communication reason. The thing we need now more than anything else is enforcement of the law at every level to curtail illegal hunting, illegal wildlife trade, and to stop illegal development.
I'm Lynne Malcolm, and in this edition of Balancing Nature here on ABC Radio National Science Show, I'll be examining the remarkable wealth of Vietnam's newly discovered biodiversity. And as this socialist republic strives to become an industrialised country by 2020, how can it safeguard its rich mosaic of species, given the pressures of population and development?
There is everything to win and virtually everything to lose. If biodiversity is not protected here over the next few years, these mountains will lose their unique value forever.
The Annamites, a chain of mountains straddling Vietnam's border with Cambodia and Laos for over 1,200 kilometres. Here, rich tropical rainforests reach misty peaks up to 2,500 metres high, home to more than 1,200 species of plants and 7,000 species of animals. It's biologically and culturally diverse. There are over 70 different ethnic groups here, living in some of the planet's least explored rainforests. Several critically threatened animals roam these mountains, such as the tiger and the Javan rhinoceros. But its true uniqueness has come from recent discoveries of little-known large mammals.
The most famous one was the sao lao, which is a forest antelope, and was the first large mammal species to be discovered anywhere in the world since 1936.
Barney Long, a biologist with Worldwide Fund for Nature, has been conducting surveys here for the last 7 years.
There's been 4 other large mammal species discovered in the Annamite Mountains, as well as numerous birds, plants, reptiles and amphibians, a whole range of them. With the smaller species, like frogs, if you want to find a new species, you can go out and find one pretty easily, I would think.
And in the last few years, the discovery of orchids, aspidistras and the endemic Vietnamese ginseng highlight the amazing range of new plants in the Annamites. But why is this area so biodiverse? Eleanor Sterling, director of the Centre for Biodiversity at the American Museum of Natural History, is constantly drawn here to fill the huge gaps in the taxonomy of these rare habitats.
This area is a mountainous area in an otherwise flat region. And there's a possibility that these species, during times of massive climate change around the world, the habitats would have changed in Vietnam, especially in a coastal area. And a mountainous area would allow for the preservation of certain kinds of ecosystems. As the climate changed, these ecosystems could move up or down a mountain, for instance, in relation to changes in temperature or amount of rainfall. And so it could serve as a refugium for some species and allow for those species to essentially remain in an area over long periods of time.
One of the most spectacular and iconic animals currently being surveyed is what's considered the most beautiful primate in the world, the tree-dwelling Duke Langur. They're known by locals as the five-coloured monkey, with their distinctive orange face, silver whiskers, red and blue markings, and a 1 metre long white tail. Barney Long was lucky enough to encounter an unusually large population.
We had a fantastic sighting where we were on top of a mountain, the canopy 10 metres below us, and we heard some noise, so we went over and we started seeing two groups that had come together. There was about 20 animals. But then some stump-tailed macaques, which are a type of monkey, liked the fruit that the dukes were eating, so started moving into the tree and actually had a fight with the dukes and pushed the dukes away. That was fantastic to watch, actually seeing those interactions going on between the two species.
So what do you know about the animal, about its habitat and about its behaviour?
We've identified them in very degraded habitat as well as very pristine habitat. And from lowland to mid-altitude, and if not hunted, they live at high densities. Unfortunately, they've heavily hunted over the last few decades, and now it's quite hard to find them, and when you do, they tend to be at very depleted densities.
Surveying rare animals in these mountainous landscapes is challenging, to say the least, and so much so that the recently rediscovered chestnut-coloured sowler has become an enigma to scientists. It famously came to their attention in 1992 when they found a pair of long, straight, spindly horns hung on a village hunter's wall, which has since triggered the quest to see them in the wild. But so far, scientists have only seen the sowler in photographs. The Vietnamese Forest Protection Department has set up camera traps to capture images of these shy, solitary animals.
We set cameras in those areas we suspect sowler inhabit, based on information from the locals. Along the trails where we think the sowler go, particularly near streams where sowler drink and where their preferred food supply is, as the sowler crosses the camera beam, it will set off the camera.
Do you expect that this camera trapping will help you to define particular conservation areas for the future?
Cameras will help to establish the size of the proposed reserve to save sowler and other species in the region. But it's not just based on camera trapping. The locals are good at recognizing footprints. Just last month, they confirmed they had seen sets of them. So from that, together with setting up camera traps and regularly checking on the trap images, we can work out where the animals are. But it's not easy. It can be quite challenging to get to cameras on steep slopes when it rains for days on end like today.
You need a passion and love for this because there's a lot of hardship and you need to continually improve your knowledge to meet all the demands of the job. If you, as I did, had the chance to hold a one-month baby sowler and feel how gentle and cute it is, you would do your best to save the nature and environment that's here.
Mr. Khan is the director of the Forest Protection Department in the Hue province. He's one of the lucky few to have seen the sowler in the wild and gained the few clues about its behaviour and habitat.
In this province, sowler usually live in an area upstream, near two branches of the Perfum River. It shelters in caves and grottos. It's very timid and has a good nose for the presence of other animals. We came here a few years ago to release a pregnant sowler trapped in a canyon. Locals later told me they observed a mother and a baby in the forest. We've since done a lot of campaigning amongst the locals to encourage them to take part in sowler conservation, and we are planning for this area to become a natural reserve for sowler.
Yet surveying and conserving Vietnam's rich biodiversity is complicated by several factors. Many people live deep within these forests, so it's not an option to create vast protected areas that exclude humans. The forest resources will always be linked to their livelihood. Huang Van Thang, an ecologist and director of the Centre for Resources and Environment in Hanoi, says it's crucial to involve these local communities in all conservation activities.
You know, tropical jungles are really dense and difficult to access. The local peoples have been very helpful in terms of providing information not only regarding the species, but also the status and the situation of their areas, especially in the deep jungle. because more than other people, including scientists, local people know much better about their areas.
So one of the things that you're needing to do is balance conservation of species and the needs and lifestyles of the people. Is this a good way of engaging the people in helping to protect biodiversity in these areas?
Oh, definitely. The conservationist alone and the government officer alone cannot protect all the nature and conserve on the biodiversity. We got to have the support and contributions from the local people as well as from the local leaders. And to do that, we got to help them increase their living standards, their awareness, and also their capacities. So in that terms, we can involve them and encourage them to take part in the conservation. And one of the ways to do that, in our opinion, is that try to balance, we call it trade-offs, between conservation and development. How to balance it? That's still a very big question and we are trying to answer now.
You're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National and our series Balancing Nature. I'm Lynn Malcolm and I'm heading to Songtang Nature Reserve in Quangnam Province, the largest protected area in the Annamite Mountains and home to tigers, gibbons and the biggest population of grey-shanked duck. But every few kilometres, evidence of new dam projects to stem the country's chronic power shortage is rife. Jonathan Eames of BirdLife International helped formulate the government's Biodiversity Action Plan, which successfully instigated a system of national protected areas. But now, he says, the action plan has moved into a new phase.
Any national park you care to name has got a road now going through it, or one planned, or there's a dam project. All these are in clear violation of national park legislation, but still they go through because of vested interests, and at the end of the day, the government can always say, well, it's in the national interest and this overrides everything else. But it would undoubtedly help if there was more of a clear and transparent planning process, and environmental impact assessment is relatively new in the Vietnamese context and tends to be undertaken in a rather covert manner, so no one knows when one is done and the results are never made public anyway. I think only when we reach that point can we hope to have a greater impact on trying to stop inappropriate project development.
We've just turned onto the Ho Chi Minh Highway. It's a major north-south artery, newly built along the tracks of the old Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was developed during the American War. Barney Long, this road's cutting through some really lush forest. It must put a lot of pressure on the surrounding environment.
From a development point of view, it's opening up lots of the remote communities in the mountainous areas in western Vietnam, giving them much easier access to markets so that they can sell their products, as well as obviously making it easier for goods from the lowland to make their way up to the mountainous areas, such as healthcare and better education.
And what are some of the ways in which you can mitigate some of the destructive effects that the highway might have on the country around?
Well, there's two main environmental impacts that the highway's had. The first is that it's fragmenting the forested landscape into smaller blocks. This means all the plants and animals within these areas, the population is effectively halved, which means they're less viable over the long term. There's nothing you can do about the actual highway and the break in the highway, but what you can do is ensure that agricultural encroachment does not happen along the highway, and that where there's bare land either side of the highway, forest is replanted. The other major impact it's having is that it's majorly increasing the access to previously very remote forest, and this means that illegal activities such as logging and hunting have massively increased in these very remote areas. And these were previously the last refuges of some of the most important species here in Vietnam. The way to stop this is law enforcement and working with the communities to reduce the amount of forest products that are needed to be harvested by local communities.
The Taban Commune in the Songtang Nature Reserve is a collection of 9 villages covering 300 square kilometres in some of Vietnam's most species-rich forest. It's recently reached new agreements about which areas of their forest should be protected and which should be used for sustainable cultivation after lengthy negotiations with the reserve's rangers. Mr. Kia is head of the commune.
Before, when people were not aware of the forest's importance, people here developed their own economies by cutting down trees.
hunting animals and cultivating crops. Now people here are deterred from entering the forest. They have their own area for rice paddies, and they know the importance of forest protection. Local government regulations now stipulate no entry into large areas of the forest, and the people know that and don't invade it.
To help reach decisions about land use in the Tabin commune, everyone from school children to elders came together to build a scaled 3D model of their region. It's made from coloured card, beads and other handicraft materials, and it's proudly displayed at the offices of the Nature Reserve. It serves to combine long-held local knowledge of the forest with the government's conservation aims.
One village per day came in and plotted all their local information onto the model. So they named all the streams and rivers and the mountains and different forest areas. And then they mapped their agricultural areas and which areas they used traditionally for collecting forest products and doing their cultural rituals. So all of this is mapped out for the 9 different villages.
It's really quite lovely to look at. It's almost an artifact itself. It's got the blue rivers running through it, and all different coloured strings and yarns, all meaning something different, I gather.
Even this one strange-shaped bead here, which is a helicopter base from the American War. I guess the most important thing that it's achieved is communication. It's enabled the rangers of the reserve to understand the way the community perceive the forest in terms of ownership and access, and it's also allowed the communities to be able to express their wishes for what should happen in each of the different areas that they know by a local name, which usually cannot be translated onto a topographic map that the rangers understand. So it's really been a communication tool which has helped develop effective cooperation between communities and the reserve.
Many of these communities are dependent on forest products for at least half their income. So how can an effective balance be achieved between preserving the forest and their livelihood? Well, part of the answer lies in the growing worldwide demand for non-timber forest products, such as bamboo and rattan, and is proving a great incentive for villagers such as Nia, who's clearly proud of using the forest in a new, sustainable way.
You see women on the Ho Chi Minh Highway carrying heavy baskets of firewood on their backs. Rattan is used to make strong baskets that we can sell to markets at a good price.
It looks a little bit like very thin palm leaves, and it's got spikes off the trunk of it, and it's towering up above us. It looks very strong.
We can cultivate rattan here under the canopy of the forest, where it can grow up to 20 to 30 metres high. Before, this area was slashed and burned by local people for their farming. But by working the forest in this way, it helps reduce flooding, landslides, and enables us to retain water in a controlled way for our rice fields.
As head of the commune, I think we can certainly benefit from protecting the forest environment. In fact, building our commune regulation and rules has helped to clarify the management of different villages and the areas that belong to them.
But increasing a community's rights and say over the forest also increases their concerns about illegal intruders. And as part of their sustainable management of the forest, villagers are now being trained as forest patrollers. They help to monitor plants and animals, as well as keep out intruders who frequently exploit forest resources. They're supported by armed rangers from Quang Nam's Forest Protection Department, who intercept the more serious cases.
My team have just returned from the forest, having detained 10 illegal intruders. We've just set up a new mobile team stationed at this road post. It's a major route for illegal gold mining, the illegal wildlife trade, and illegal logging. So we have 3 things to deal with here.
When you encounter some illegal activity here, what are you able to do? Do you confiscate their tools and weapons, or are you able to arrest them?
When we find illegal gold miners, for instance, we collect all the equipment and destroy it and hand them over to the Forest Protection Department HQ, who issue a criminal conviction.
A lorry is pulled over. It's a prime suspect for smuggling mining equipment up from the lowlands. There's currently a gold rush on in Quangnam province, in some of the most inaccessible forest, where there's an abundance of rare endemic plants and animals, and where chemicals from mining can wreak havoc on the soil and river systems. This time, the truck is just carrying provisions for one of the villagers and gets the all clear.
Many illegal intruders keep coming back, and they know us. And when it comes to the illegal wildlife trade, they have their own ways. Carrying traps or catches in a small bag, that's not so easy to detect.
So you have to be quite clever and quite cunning in the way you move around the forest.
It's a game of dog and cat. Just last week, we caught and returned a 38-kilogram python, a muntjac, and a scaly anteater. When you get information from village patrollers, you have to act on it 24 hours a day.
Early morning is the best time to capture the sounds of the forest. I've driven northwards to Hue Province, home to the critically endangered white-cheeked crested gibbon. Chris Dickinson is Worldwide Fund for Nature's head ecologist in Hue, whose team's biological surveys have marked this area out as one of the highest conservation priorities in the Central Annamites.
Yes, we're overlooking the proposed nature reserve for the Saola, and we often see gibbons here. We've been doing surveys for them over the past 2 years, and in the whole province of Hue, there's about 60 or 70 different groups of gibbons here.
And any of the other sounds that you can identify here?
There's a few birds, a laughing thrush, and a few cuckoos in the background as well. And there's probably about a couple of hundred species of bird in this area. And we have done some bird surveys, and it's very important for crested argus, which is a type of pheasants with a very long, beautiful tail.
It's vital to maintain a healthy biodiverse forest in this mountainous landscape. Flooding of the lowlands and coastal towns during monsoon is a real risk, and a healthy forest can offset this danger. At the moment, 53% of the province is forest covered, and we've set a target of 60% forest covered by 2020.
Forest Protection Department's Mr. Khan is overseeing an ambitious plan to connect the three major reserves in the Hue province in an attempt to restore the forest cover and secure its biodiversity.
The landscape will connect up all together so that we can get a better balance between pockets of development and the environment. And we've just issued new conservation policies that will make locals the owners of their area and not make them feel that conservation is pressing down on them, but in a sense serves them.
It's a radical break with the Socialist Republic's past, when up to now all land has been owned by the state. This new approach, being piloted by Hue's Forest Protection Department, transfers ownership and management of the forest to the communities. Chris Dickinson from WWF has been facilitating the plan.
It's basically a way of empowering the local people to be able to manage the forests, and then we are empowering them through a series of training and capacity building, which enables them to work out how much timber they can use for their own purposes, timber, firewood, fencing and poles. And also, if the forest is rich enough, they can also sell some for income generation in the future. And we think that this is the best way for sustainable forest management, by giving this ownership and local governance capacity to the local people.
And how is it progressing? How's the response been?
We think that it will start off slow because, of course, the government are a bit perhaps worried or tentative to upscale before they have working examples. And it is quite a long process of building capacity of both the government officials, the local people as well, to be able to monitor and manage and assess these areas. But we're quite hopeful it's the long-term future of forests in Vietnam.
And the future of Vietnam's forests also depends on the very characteristics which make it so special. As we heard earlier, this mountainous landscape has been an ancient refuge for unique plants and animals. And in the wake of current climate change predictions, researchers such as Barney Long are cautiously optimistic that the Annamites could serve as a refuge again if we have the foresight to build a degree of resilience into these habitats.
In the Central Annamites, we've been looking at potential connectivity of the whole forest landscape, either latitudinal and longitudinal connectivity or altitudinal connectivity. This means if the temperature and the whole climate does change, the distributions of habitats and species can shift
with that change, either up or downhill, or north or south, or east or west. So really it's a matter of planning the landscape at the large level, looking at land use changes to see where is most effective to protect over the long term and to restore.
As Vietnam rapidly moves towards industrialization, its newly emerging status as a global refuge for biodiversity will depend on widespread public awareness about its role in the development of the country's society, economy and culture. Jonathan Eames is optimistic that if appropriate priority is given to conservation, a healthy balance is all within the realms of possibility.
You don't need a huge national park necessarily to conserve the populations of a small bird or a medium-sized monkey. Now, these areas are gazetted under the law, so if we could only ramp up and improve the enforcement, I think there's every reason to believe we could conserve all of them. We wouldn't need to lose any.
I think here we've got an opportunity that so much won't be lost. If we can secure, at the very least, the protected area network and then corridors between those, I think the biodiversity of the Annamites will be able to survive into the future. But it is going to take an enormous effort on the government to think long-term and put long-term sustainability at the forefront of all their thinking rather than short-term profits.
The next program in our series, Balancing Nature, shifts from land to sea. The Philippines has recently been described as the centre of the centre of marine biodiversity. In exploring its underwater riches, I'll discover how attempts to restore its marine ecology could turn the tide of the destruction caused by pollution and overfishing. Join me then.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.